Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome to The Critic's podcast. I'm Olivia Hartley, publisher of The Critic, and I'm joined today by Laura Dodsworth, who's an author and journalist and a Critic contributor. Laura wrote an article for the May 22 print edition of The Critic titled The False Euphoria of Dysphoria. And in this article, Laura was looking at what appeared to be a Snapchat series created by Pink News, which appears to glorify gender transition and the sort of worrying impact this might have on young people. Laura, for those who don't know about this video, how did you come across it in the first place and what was your reaction to it?
Well, I first came across it because I saw a Pink News tweet about it, and I think it's called, yeah, it's called Pure Trans Joy. So they've launched a series of videos called Pure Trans Joy. And this first episode I saw promoted was quite attention-grabbing because it showed a trans man. So that is someone who's a female who identifies as a man. So someone who was a woman who's now a trans man. I know that sounds like a very lumbering explanation, but it can be confusing for people. Yeah. So I had a picture of a trans man, and I think he's shirtless in the image. And so you know this is somebody who was once a woman and they've had what's called top surgery. So I was curious enough, because this has been a field of interest for me for a while, to go and find the video and watch it. And I was quite astonished by it. I think that it would be very positively welcomed by trans men, and that is the whole point. This is about celebrating gender transition for people who have transitioned. But I felt some concerns about how positive it was without any attempt at balance. So no caveats about the surgery, no words of caution. And the thing that struck me about this video as well was, for such an unbalanced piece of content, it was on Snapchat, which is mainly used by young girls. The biggest demographic to use Snapchat are girls aged 13 to 17. So what happens in the video is you start off with a little explanation of what top surgery is. Now, top surgery is a term I take a bit of issue with, because for a start, it's very euphemistic. What it is essentially bilateral mastectomy. It's having both of your breasts removed. And that's as a treatment for gender dysphoria, for dysphoric females. Well, for some, not all of them. It doesn't explain that could be painful, that it's irreversible. And it uses words all the way through, like euphoria, freedom, joy, best day of my life, and even the bliss of fairy dust. You know, this is very, very euphoric and positive and quite young. You know, a term like the bliss of fairy dust feels quite juvenile, really. And I was quite worried about the vulnerability of young girls watching this video. It's such a difficult, sensitive area to go into, because you know that if you do, you will be called transphobic.
Absolutely.
And yet it is so important to present both sides of the story and raise awareness of this. I mean, at the moment, there's been a lot of furore about gender conversion therapy and trans women sports stars and trans women in prisons. You know, these big issues get talked about. The conversion therapy one is particularly interesting. The problem is, by the time that a girl gets to the doctor's surgery, she's already watched a video like this or other online social media content, which has confirmed her in her own mind.
Hmm. I think it's interesting because your piece has quite a lot of detail and research in it, particularly from Jess Taylor's new book, Sexy But Psycho, about how kind of a decade ago it was mostly boys transitioning into girls, so to speak, but now it's pretty much the reverse, and most of the sort of patients that are appearing at these gender clinics, it's more girls wanting to come to turn into boys, so to speak. And I thought the video was interesting. I did look at it after seeing your piece, and you're right, it presents everything as joyful, as if removing these parts of your, you know, womanhood is a freedom. Do you think that they've said that actually because there are difficulties associated with having a female body? Do you think, in a sense, that they're almost erasing womanhood?
Yeah, so really important to refer to Dr. Jessica Taylor's book there. Back in 2009, 75% of the young people presenting at gender identity clinics were male. But a decade later, 70% of them were female. So the mix completely swapped around. And so you have to think, what's going on there? What does that mean? Now, I can't answer that definitively, and the fact is nobody can, because gender identity clinics haven't been doing research on it. Mm. People have been accepting this really uncritically. Transgender activists will say it's because there's more visibility and acceptance of trans people. And that would partly explain the increase in numbers, but not the change in the ratio. My personal view is that in the teenage years, a lot of girls feel uncomfortable with their burgeoning womanhood. You know, there's that time when you grow breasts, your body projects you into womanhood, and you're not necessarily ready for it. From interviewing women who detransitioned for a feature produced for the Sunday Times called The Detransitioners, every woman I came across in that piece and in wider research had either experienced sexual abuse or harassment, or was a lesbian and experienced internalised homophobia or externalised, or had some form of neurodiversity. And added to that, maybe body image issues, body dysmorphia, could be anorexia or bulimia. And it seems there are certain vulnerabilities like that which could be contributing to a feeling that they are gender dysphoric. And of course, there's also the theory of rapid onset gender dysphoria, which was developed by Dr. Lisa Lippman. This has been very controversial, but it's something that seems to intuitively make sense as well, that certain ideas can spread through social contagion and peer contagion. So it's not the idea that going onto the internet just makes you transgender. I mean, that's a ludicrous idea. Mm. But it could be that if you're in a certain vulnerable state, by coming across positive content about being transgender, it might make you feel like that's the solution. And that is very much what this video does.
Definitely. It presents it as a means to an end, doesn't it? Like, you have this and you're going to be totally euphoric, but we know from research that feelings of dysphoria can go on no matter how much surgery or gender affirming care you've had.
Yeah, I mean, it basically says if you have top surgery, you won't feel uncomfortable for the rest of your life. And you know, you young girls watching it might have completely different reasons thrown into the mix there, thrown into this, you know, hormonal difficult stage of life melting pot, which explain why they're uncomfortable with their body and their breasts. And they're watching a video saying, that's the answer, that's the solution. It doesn't provide any balance. I mean, there's really never been such a welcoming counterculture. Now, the interesting thing about this, imagine you found a video on Snapchat that was all about breast enhancement surgery that's for young girls. Can you imagine the reaction if it was about breast augmentation? There'd be an absolute outcry, wouldn't there?
Mm.
So some people say, oh, but you shouldn't mix this up, because one is a treatment for gender dysphoria and one's about improving your body image. But they're both types of breast surgery and they're both irreversible.
Yeah, no, they're both types of breast surgery. I think that links to an interesting point that you made in the piece, where you're saying that on platforms like Snapchat, material that promotes other forms of like body dysmorphia or eating disorders or self-harm is banned. And is there not a hypocrisy there in the fact that they are then allowed to platform what is essentially the glorification of double mastectomies on gender dysphoric young people?
Well, I think so. But you know what? It actually feels really uncomfortable to say that, even to you, in a critic podcast. This should be the place. I'm at least reasonably comfortable to say that, but I'm not. I'm uncomfortable saying it because since the piece has come out, I have been told I'm transphobic a few times. And I am not transphobic. I just think that in a video that is effectively promoting or glorifying breast removal on a platform for young girls, we really need to be careful because it is irreversible. I mean, it's promoting the idea of amputating parts of the body.
Mm.
And there's this idea that if it's for gender dysphoria, it's okay. It's like it's sprinkled, not with the bliss of fairy dust, but with magical gender dust. That makes it okay. Yes, Snapchat and the other platforms quite rightly take a strong editorial policy on self-harm, eating disorders, etc. Added to that, you've also got the General Medical Council and the Advertising Standards Authority who've said that plastic surgery advertising should not be targeted at under 18s, and that includes social media platforms. That would include top surgery, as it's called. It would include bilateral mastectomy. So, you know, there's a really fine line here. Now, this Pink News video is not advertising. It's a piece of editorial. It doesn't fall under those ASA guidelines. Mm. Other content by top surgeons on Instagram does tread a much finer line.
Well, how do these people not get in trouble? They're posting basically before and after pictures of these people. Mm. I don't know what the stats are for Instagram, but I know that for Snapchat, well, it's primarily 13 to 17-year-olds. I imagine it's different for Instagram, but still there's a very big presence of young people on there.
Mm.
And, you know, you sent a lot of these screenshots through of these top surgeons, so to speak, posting before and after, happy photos. That picture of the doctor holding the buckets of breast tissue and smiling were absolutely horrific.
Mm.
And, you know, if we're horrified at that, and think how many young people are seeing that, how do you solve this? Do we need to legislate? Do these companies need to have better safeguarding procedures in place to make sure what material is disseminated and promoted and what isn't? You know, they're giving these people blue ticks.
I don't actually know what the answer is. It's really tricky because I would err away from legislation where possible, but young people are not being protected by this. Now, I asked the Advertising Standards Authority about whether the accounts of top surgeons, so these are plastic surgeons that might be specialising in breast removal for gender dysphoric girls, women, would fall foul of the new guidelines. And they said maybe. The thing is, you know, a plastic surgeon is allowed an Instagram account. That in itself is not advertising. But if that account is only used for before and after photographs, they've got to be treading a very fine line. Interesting thing about the before and after photographs is the before photographs show a girl who identifies as a girl who has breasts and nipples, and those nipples have to be covered with little digital modesty stickers. And the after photos, it's the same body, the same person, the same flesh, the same nipples.
It's
literally the same nipples, but some of the breast tissue behind has been removed. But this person has removed their breast tissue and now identifies as male. Those nipples are uncovered. I mean, nothing gets across how bonkers censorship is, and it is literally sexist. To treat the sexes differently is literally sexism. It's sexist, it's bonkers, but it also gets to this quite, for me, quite upsetting idea that it's this female tissue which is wrong, which is sexualized, which is inherently offensive. And that is summed up in that image you described. So for people who won't know what this is about, there was an American surgeon holding a bucket in each hand. These are medical waste buckets and they're labelled as such. And he's put an extra sticker, an extra label on each one that says breast tissue. So, and he's wearing a Santa Claus hat, just very odd, disgusting. Very odd festive themed photo. But it literally says, you know, it's literally saying to me, female flesh is trash. And to get rid of this unwanted sexual tissue, you know, it freights you with the burden of obscenity. You have it cut off, it gets put into a medical waste bin and thrown away. So this is where it gets really tricky. You know, I've written this article and been called transphobic by a few people. But for me, when I see a photograph like that, of breast tissue in medical waste buckets, I feel very sad. I felt sickened. I feel appalled. and very worried on behalf of the young women that had that procedure. There'll be women who've had that procedure, well, trans men, who might always be delighted with their decision and feel that they are much more comfortable in their bodies that way. You know, whatever anyone thinks, that maybe that makes them happy and that's fine. But I've interviewed women detransitioners who regret it bitterly, and there is no getting the breast tissue back. A bilateral mastectomy is permanent and it's irreversible.
Yeah, I think it's very telling that on Instagram, what is literally the... I mean, the Free the Nipple whole social media campaign has been going on for years anyway, and it shocks me that this is allowed on this. It's just so clear that they're erasing parts of womanhood. And I mean, do you see this kind of in this trend as like a wider phenomenon, should we say, of the erasure of womanhood? We're just removing women from so many different aspects of biological functions that are typically associated with our sex.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to link the two things there, but there certainly is, it does feel like there is a link. I mean, my book, Bare Reality, 100 Women, Their Breasts, Their Stories, came out in 2015, and that book cover's been censored all over the place. I think I've been kicked off every social media platform at one point, probably. I've been taken off Facebook 3 times and had some of my passport photos to get back on. And that's simply because I've inadvertently shared the book cover, which has female nipples on it. So obviously there is no obscenity attached to female nipples whatsoever. Mm. You know, when it comes down to it, breasts are mammary glands, actually. We're mammals, and the sexual connotations are very culturally driven, and there's also nothing wrong with the sexualization of breasts. Nothing wrong with it. You know, it's fine. Yeah. Let's enjoy it. But there's nothing that is inherently different about the nipples. What's really being deemed obscene is the sexualization of women. The non-sexualization of women. Because the cover of my book is not sexual at all. Now, do you remember when Kim Kardashian broke the internet? You see her from behind. She's very old up. She's got her big sexy booty out.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, know the photo.
It's all over Instagram, all over the internet. That's fine. That's completely fine.
But even the non-sexual appearance of a woman, even just a normal photo, for even medical purposes, is somehow worse or more sexual deeming of censorship. Yeah.
So that's what's confronting. And that's where the social media platforms have gradually introduced rules such as you can see breasts while at least one breast is in the process of active breastfeeding. Or you can see one breast if the other breast has been removed via mastectomy for cancer, for medical reasons or body image reasons. You know, you've got all these strange caveats of when a breast may or may not be permitted.
Mm.
It is very strange. It's very strange. Back to the top surgeons. There are lots of accounts all over Instagram now of top surgeons who are promoting this kind of surgery to women who are, well, to teenagers, to girls, actually. The one I sent you images of, let's not say the name of it now, because I might write and do a follow-up piece on this, actually. You know, they have an FAQ section, and it says, you know, if I want this under the age of 18, can I? And the doctor says no, because the hospital doesn't allow it. So the answer is no, because I'm not allowed. Not no, because you're young and you may need to explore if this is the right thing for you.
Hmm.
They're very much trying to hook in young girls, I think.
I think it's crazy as well that, so you mentioned a lot of like the crowdfunding aspects of these top surgeries and how they've sort of ballooned in recent years. Should there not also be checks on these? You know, the people that are donating to these, you don't know how old they are. Sometimes they're as young as 14, 15, 16. They're raising thousands and thousands of dollars for their top surgery. But also in itself, particularly as it pertains to the UK, do you think this is a failing in trans healthcare almost, as we have in the UK, you know, care that can help those that are struggling with gender dysphoria? Do you think enough is being done rather than investing the time and the money in therapy that isn't affirmative?
I don't think anyone's being rushed into surgery on the NHS in the UK. For one thing, the waiting lists are too long, and I don't think that's our approach. And there may be people who are trying to get private surgery. When we talk about the GoFundMes, a lot of those are US procedures. Yes, so in 2020, there were 27,000 results for top surgery. And just recently, when I looked, there were 41,582. I mean, 41,000 women asking for people to donate to their top surgeries is a significant number. Yeah, I don't think that people who are gender dysphoric get quick enough access to healthcare in the UK. I think the results of the CAS review ultimately will probably be very enlightening on that. There's no point in me trying to preempt it. But, you know, one problem is the waiting list, and the other problem is that the care is so affirmative.
Yeah, that is a problem. And, you know, thankfully, it's also deemed conversion therapy, apparently, if you're not affirming gender dysphoria, which is mad, because you wouldn't affirm other types of body dysphoria or dysmorphia, such as eating disorders, which many people view as basically the same thing.
Well, this is where you get this really strange ideological split. You know, there are some people who think that this is so entirely different to any other type of body dysmorphia that it warrants a completely different treatment to everything else that we do in medicine. Now, for all their sins, and you know, let's not go into that. I think the Conservative Party has made the right call on not banning conversion therapy for trans people, because that's not something that's happening. There isn't conversion therapy for trans people anymore. But what that ban would have done would be to restrict completely legitimate, good psychotherapy, you know, talking therapy for young people to explore why they feel dysphoric, you know, what are the multifactorial reasons maybe behind it, and what treatment is right for them. The purely affirmative approach is, I think, why we have the detransitioned women that I've interviewed for that other project. That's why we have women that have experienced that. I mean, for this piece I wrote for you, I went back to Sinead from that project. Now, she was she didn't hold back on the Pink News video. Can I swear on your podcast?
Yes.
Yeah, she described it as a fucking train wreck. She was really upset by it. And she just wishes that the medical care that she'd had questioned what was going on with her, because she had been sexually abused, which was a big part of why she was gender dysphoric. And it wasn't explored. And she's angry with the doctors who looked after her.
In your detransitioners work, you also mentioned about how a lot of these women have now been ostracised from their community. And ever since, you know, you've published this piece, you say that you've had a fair bit of kickback. But in your bare reality work of the, I know you're loath to call it 100 vaginas, it should have been 100 vulvas, am I right?
The film of it should have been called 100 vulvas, obviously, but Channel 4 wanted to call it 100 vaginas, which I get, it's much snappier, everyone knows what a vagina is.
But it's not correct.
It's not correct, there's a lot of confusion about what a vulva is. They would have thought I was making a film about 100 Swedish cars. But yeah, the book was called Womanhood, The Bare Reality, and there was a Channel 4 documentary called 100 Vaginas.
Yeah, and you made the decision to, you included a trans woman in that, didn't you? Which
I
at
did.
The time was probably, you know, quite radical, and it was some way of showing representation of trans women. But is that something that you would change now, knowing what you know and feeling how you feel?
No, absolutely not. I've included trans people in all three of my books. So Bare Reality, which was about breasts, Manhood, which was about men, and Womanhood, 100 Vaginas, which was about vulvas. Now, oh, it's funny how I said men, not penises, didn't I? I'm allowed to swear, so I could definitely see the word penis on your podcast, can't I? There we go, 100
penises. This is a safe space.
No, I wouldn't. Now, I think I did a bit of 180 on gender over the course of the three books, but I would still go back and include trans people in all of them. Now, first of all, that's because they are artistic projects that are exploring what womanhood and manhood mean. I did get pushback from both trans activists and radical feminists. You can't please all the people all the time, Olivia. It's just completely impossible. But I want to have artistic license to do what I want, basically. Look, if I was told I should have called Bare Reality 98 women and 2 trans men. But I mean, that's not a catchy title, is it?
No.
Apart from anything else, it's just not catchy.
Won't sell.
It doesn't work as a title. And I think it's okay to have a bit of artistic license. I tell you what, there's no way on earth that Channel 4 would have made the film without non-binary and trans representation. That doesn't mean they drove it. They absolutely didn't. In a way, I had ultimate casting control because nobody could be in the book unless they were. Nobody could be in the film unless they were in the book. But I think it was really good to include a trans woman in the project. It just made it richer and more interesting because it's about how somebody who was a man identified as a woman and the journey they went on.
Mm.
But it upset a few radical feminists.
Of course.
Who thought it wasn't the correct purist approach. And, you know, I was told, you know, can't women have anything to themselves, including a project about vaginas? And I get that point of view. But there were also trans people that were upset with me who said that I was defining being a sex on the basis of the body parts they had. So you can't win. You can't win. But the books were literally an exploration of our sexed experience of the world. But I also had non-binary people in each of the books.
I think this just goes to show you that when you sort of dip your toes into the water on this subject, you are pretty much damned if you do, damned if you don't. The camps on either side are split massively. I know that's the same for the gender criticals as well as it is for the trans rights activists.
Oh, can I say something? You see, you've asked me about having a trans woman in womanhood, but you haven't asked me about having a woman in manhood. Because everyone always concentrates on the trans women. There's actually a woman in manhood, although I don't know how this person would describe themselves anymore. At the time, it was non-binary. So this is a female person, a woman describes herself as non-binary, who wore a prosthetic penis all the time.
Right. I didn't actually know that. If I'd know about that, that would have been... Yeah. I would have asked, but you're showing up my prejudices here.
And the kind of person I'm really curious. So when I was working on manhood, this man said, oh, I've got somebody you should definitely interview. I was like, great. You know, gosh, when you're working on a project like this, any lead is important. You know, it's not like you can find 100 people to take their clothes off easily. And when I found out it was going to be a woman that wears a prosthetic penis, I was intrigued. You know, of course they could take part. I'm then dying to interview somebody like that and work out how they feel about their body and why they do that. I've already forgotten the word for it. Anyway, they were like a small flaccid one for everyday use and then a bigger one for sexual use.
Right. Well, you heard it here first. This is informative. What? So you never followed up with this person? You don't know kind of how they decided to...
Yeah, they're in the book.
No, but afterwards, nowadays, like have they...
Oh, no, I can't follow up with everybody.
Yeah.
No, that's hundreds of people.
That's fair enough. But...
Some I stay in touch with.
But I mean, as I was saying, like the camp is very split and you've sort of, some of your work's found itself in the middle there. You kind of have the moderates, those who think that there's no room to give an inch at all on either side, which can make it quite difficult. Where do you stand and where do you think the more gender critical movement has to go?
I think the gender critical movement in this country has been doing brilliantly, to be honest. I don't think I have any advice for it. I consider myself as part of it in a way, although I'm not sure if I'm seen as part of it or not, because I take an artistic approach and that's not the same as somebody who's writing politically based articles or campaigning with political parties all the time. You know what, you need different approaches. You need people who are more hardline and people who are more moderate, and then they reach people differently. I think that a lot of people lose compassion for the individuals and we shouldn't do that. So I hear gender critical feminists criticising trans women who have big hands and things like that. I just think that's horrible.
It's quite ad hominem at times.
Yeah, it doesn't advance any argument and it just comes off as mean. So that's not me. I'd rather be compassionate and listen to all the stories. I'm interested in the stories.
Yeah, interested in stories, but you also, you know, have your principles which you stick to, and the proof's in the pudding, isn't it? Look at your work. So people can call you transphobic, but what would you say to them? You would say, look at my...
Oh, I'm not absolutely not transphobic. I can't say I'm close friends with anyone who's trans, but I'm friends with people who are trans and on good terms with them. I'll just go back to, you can't please all the people all the time, and it becomes an ideological split. It's like when people are religious, they become more and more hardline in their views the deeper they go into it. And I probably walk quite a moderate line.
I think I know quite a few people like that as well. So as a sort of final sort of closing point, when we were talking about this piece a couple of months ago to come in the mag, it seemed to me like you could have written a book on this. I think I could have given you 50,000 words and it wouldn't have been enough. There's so much to go into here. And obviously the extended version online is an extended version of what was in the mag. But you said there's still so much more to go into. What else do you think needs to be spoken about here? What else do you think needs to go into? What else is there to say?
Well, I'd probably be going into the territory of existing books that are already out there and fantastic, like Material Girls and Trans and Irreversible Damage. There are already quite a few books in this field. I think it's just that each person you interview, you think, oh, that's interesting. I could go deeper into that. I would probably be interested in finding more people who have detransitioned. There just isn't enough robust empirical data, and there aren't enough of the qualitative stories. I found many more when I was researching that piece, but who weren't comfortable with being in a photographic feature.
Right.
So just a book could encompass more. But it's always good to stick to your word limit, Olivia, because it just keeps it tighter and more readable, doesn't it?
That's true, and it gives future scope for lots of other great articles.
Yeah, do you know what I think I would like to investigate more, though? And it is that medical professionals are using social media as a window display for young people. I'll be interested to see whether the Advertising Standards Authority steps in and actually regulates those surgeons who are selling their wares quite knowingly to young girls. But I would like to follow up more. I could not get a comment from a top surgeon for the piece.
Nor Pink News, really, could you? On their Snapchat series.
Well, unfortunately, Pink, I found that quite bizarre. They wouldn't engage with any of my specific questions. They gave me a statement which didn't answer any of my questions. And I would have really liked to talk to them and give them a good sympathetic hearing and included that in. I'm much more interested in nuance than gotcha moments, but they wouldn't speak to me, and the statement is online if anybody wants to read it. It doesn't answer any of the questions.
Unfortunately, this is where no debate sort of impacts both sides, doesn't it, getting to the truth of the matter.
But you know what? I think it's because it's quite hard to answer. Why have they produced a video which is so purely positive on a platform that's mainly designed for teenage girls?
It's been a really interesting conversation. If you haven't read Laura's piece, you can read it in the May 2022 issue of The Critic magazine. There is a longer version of it online, which includes more quotes and kind of more contextual background. And watch the space. It seems like we're going to get a couple of follow-up articles potentially on this. Thanks very much, Laura, for coming on The Critic Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.